Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. I'm Ali Maxwell. With us today in the studio, you'll never guess who's here. Marcelo Bielsa. No, I'm just kidding. Michael Cox, Mark Carey, and Liam Tharm. Hi, guys.
Hello. Hello, Ali.
Imagine. Liam, you've been away since we last spoke. In Switzerland, of all places.
Yes, so I went out to Nyon to watch the Youth League final there, which was a really good time. Olympiakos beat Milan 3-0. First ever Greek, so the under-19s equivalent of the Champions League team to get that deep in the competition. Milan first Italian finalists. And yeah, really good final.
The most neutral of all venues for that. And you wrote a really interesting piece off the back of it about the UEFA Youth League. I would recommend that is bookmarked for after this podcast has been consumed. But it was another UEFA competition in which English clubs have failed miserably this season. Of course, last week, a number of English clubs crashing out of the senior UEFA competitions, Champions League, Europa League. And England now officially behind Italy and Germany in the coefficient. There's been a lot about that on site as well. Last week, we spoke about Bayer Leverkusen winning the title in Germany and breaking the Bayern Munich monopoly. And all of this stuff has got us thinking about how you compare the strength of European leagues, but also the competitiveness within them. Mark, this has in particular been a big part of your life over the last week or two. You've written a piece trying to answer questions like that from a data perspective. Was that a difficult piece to write?
It was, to look at it from a statistical perspective, because I think it's clear, and I know that Michael's written on it extensively in the past, about the, we can see by eye in certain leagues that there's a huge disparity. Germany previously being one of them, of course, not this season. But it was an interesting one to do. It was a bit of a labour of love. And because there's been a lot of talk about this UEFA coefficient, which is kind of something of a vague term, I think, that people don't quite know exactly what goes into it. So I thought, let's try and actually address it and then strip it back and see which league is the most competitive.
Michael, people love conversations about the strength of even an individual league from year to year. This is a really strong Premier League, or this feels like a very weak Premier League, but also trying to compare the strength of leagues across the continent. It's, you know, there are so many different variables, and almost we lack an actual definition of how to measure the strength of a league. When it comes to competitiveness, you've written at length about the competitiveness or lack thereof in top European divisions over the last few years. You generally focus those on the title winners and how dominant they are.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing you care about as an outsider or someone looking to follow lots of leagues. I mean, I'd like to think that I have, a fair idea of what's going on across the major European leagues, but the relegation battles I don't really know about. And I don't think too much about the difference between, or the gap between top and bottom, even though in some ways that is probably the best indicator, yes.
So that was a big part of Mark's piece, was not just focusing on the title winners and, how often it, a title is won by a different club, but also looking at measures of team quality on the one hand, and then after that, Mark, trying to understand competitiveness as the gap in quality and also in budgets and squad value between, let's say, the top teams, the bottom teams, and of course those in between.
Exactly, yeah. And I did some graphics to kind of outline that and show that, and people are very welcome to look at the piece to see that. So essentially what I did was work with a company called 21st Group, who are a sports intelligent firm. I know that you know them well as well, Ali. And they provided essentially data of each club's squad value, as you mentioned. It was using a model that ignores market factors as well, which I think is quite important considering, you know, you're talking about the Premier League, the inflation of budgets and prices in general. It was stripping all that back and just looking at each player's contribution to their team's chances of scoring goals and performing well, and then aggregating that per team or per squad to get a nice clear value. And what I did was use an analysis to essentially measure that distribution of the values of the squads within each league, what's called a Gini coefficient for each league. But essentially what this is it's an economics measure basically used to evaluate.
It's nothing to do with Gini Wijnaldum.
No, I've done this in a previous piece and I had to address it to say, no, not Wijnaldum, but let's sort of come along with me on this journey. It's used to evaluate the wealth distribution across a country's population is the long and short of it. Rather than use it in a population level, the analysis basically assessed the distribution and equality within the league. So we're calling each league a little mini population, shall we say.
Great part of your job is being smart enough to understand all these incredibly complicated algorithms, models, etc., and then just going, what if I apply that to football? Because yeah, football's more fun.
Exactly that. Yeah, that is the fun part. And I don't know how much it has been sort of done in the past. I know there's been a bit of work on it. But that's basically what I do. I basically steal from other places, other platforms, other disciplines and apply it to football. And essentially, I won't go through each individual number, but the lower the number of this coefficient, the more equal the league is. And then I sort of outline that and we can talk about some of the output.
The piece is fascinating for anyone interested in data analysis and football and the topic that we're talking about today. It's going to give us the platform really to try and go across Europe and European leagues. And really, I'm just going to try and tease out some thoughts and analysis on a carousal of European leagues and see what we can dredge up. We are not going to talk much about the Premier League. We talk about it a lot. There is a lot of known knowns when it comes to the Premier League. It's unsurprising, for example, that your analysis showed that the Premier League tops the lot for average team rating, which is a measure of the quality of the teams. But maybe less obviously for some, it had a very strong competitiveness score in terms of the equality of squad values. Now, we're in a situation where Manchester City have won 5 of the last 6 league titles. They are heavily favoured to win the league again this year. So on the one hand, in terms of pure title winners, it doesn't feel great right now in terms of that as a measure of competitiveness. But what about this idea that in terms of the equality of squad values, the Premier League actually does come out very well alongside Liga?
Yeah, and I think that it is worth saying that the Premier League is just an entity, you know, of its own in terms of the financial clout that they have with the television revenues and broadly just the amount of money that's within that league. So I think there's that as well where, you know, even the likes of Luton are getting in and around £100 million from TV revenues. That's still a lot of money compared to, you know, your average Ligue 1 team, for example. So there's that to account for it as well. And I'd be interested to get the guys' thoughts on it in terms of the wider distribution of, let's say, 6th to 16th within the Premier League, because I think that there's a real small gap there overall. But I think the thing about the Premier League in particular is that I was looking at strength and competitiveness, and the good thing about the Premier League is that it is obviously a really strong league, stronger than any other in the world, but it also has a really strong competitiveness. And we can look at Ligue 1, for example. I think it's fair to say that its strength is maybe a little bit lower, but its competitiveness is really strong, the strongest of the top 5 European leagues, top 7 European leagues. I know Liam watches the French league quite a lot, and I think it matches and passes the eye test in terms of beyond PSG, which are the obvious outlier, just how much, you know, from maybe second or third, right the way down to mid-table, I'd say, the pack could shuffle any which way to fall into a certain position, which I think is hugely interesting, makes for greater entertainment value, you know, kind of irrespective of the strength of the league.
It's the self-branded League of Talents for a reason, which I feel like I've said on this podcast before. And part of the benefit of that, of having such a pathway from really good academies across the board and bringing through young players, and when they come together in sort of a generation, teams can do really, really well. We've seen that with Monaco, that then sort of got picked apart. Lyon, who also had quite a shaky start to the season and have recovered really, really well. And even when you sort of exclude sort of PSG from being such a dominant team, the real mix of teams that end up in and around the European places or close to qualifying, there's been 10 different top six finishes in the past four seasons. Also, that would be the case, assuming Brest finish that high this season. So bar PSG, you've had Lens, Marseille, Rennes, Lille, Monaco, Nice, Strasbourg and Lyon all in the past three seasons have been up there. You've had the likes of Saint-Étienne and Nîmes, fourth and ninth in 2018-19. They're now in Ligue 2, so they're not even in the top division anymore. So it's volatile in a good and bad way in that you then get quite a mix of different teams that can compete. And at the same time, that can quite quickly sort of fall apart and teams struggle to sustain their success, which means that PSG often aren't really challenged because teams can't really stay up there for long enough to get the European revenue and to develop that squad over time. It tends to get picked apart.
Ligue 1 did move from 20 teams down to 18 not long ago. I mean, Michael, what drives a decision like that and what's the impact that it has?
Well, it should make things more competitive because the smaller the league you have, obviously the smaller the gap between top and bottom. You know, if you go back 20 years, there was a bit of a consensus in European football that leagues were too big. I mean, Sepp Blatter was for a long time trying to get all the European leagues to move to 16 teams. Now, obviously, he was head of FIFA. He was self-interested. He wanted more focus on international tournaments and maybe international club tournaments. Mm. That was kind of rejected. Then it moved towards, oh, they should be 18. And at roughly that point, Serie A actually moved from 18 to 20, so it did the opposite. But, I mean, personally speaking, I just think leagues are too big. I think they're too big when you consider, A, the fact that the gap between top and bottom is pretty big, and B, when you consider it's often the same teams winning it every year. And the argument for league seasons used to be, well, the cream will rise to the top, the best team will win it. But I actually think things are so predictable now, you don't necessarily want the best team winning it. You want a bit more unpredictability. Mm. That's more likely to come from like a 30-game season than a 42-game season or whatever. So for me, making leagues smaller makes a lot of sense.
It's quite closely tied as well to France collectively their sort of historic failures in European competitions. Obviously, the Conference League being added in now means there's extra games to certain teams. Champions League's going to expand. So it's kind of a in advance response to what's going to happen there. They've also been postponing games for the European teams. So PSG, Lille and Marseille had games all postponed between the first and second leg, I think it was, of the quarterfinals. And they're going to do the same again ahead of the semifinals. So they're trying to sort of maximise their success there. I wonder if that's in part sort of knowing that if Kylian Mbappe is departing the league, they've lost probably the face of the league for the most part. So they're trying to sort of accommodate for that. And there's only one domestic cup now as well, so they don't, you know, I know it's quite common sort of across the other European leagues. I think England probably now is more of an outlier in terms of having two, but yeah, it's just trying to sort of really channel that focus into having a, as Michael says, a competitive league and then being able to compete more on the European front as well.
I think it's worth noting as well, so it was only at the start of this season that they've moved down to 18 teams, but one of the large reasons is because they're trying to professionalize the top three divisions within France. I think the third division at the moment is semi-professional. So it's the French governing body looking to basically try and drive the competitiveness down the leagues. Obviously, we have a really strong English football pyramid and they're looking to do, I guess, something kind of similar. By then, also, yeah, having fewer teams within Ligue 1, it's going to naturally then have more competitiveness as a consequence.
Overall, Michael, given PSG's dominance, they're about to make it 10 titles in 12 years. Does that for you just mean there is such a lack of competitiveness as to make the league, therefore, basically uninteresting to you?
Yeah, I think it's a waste of time. I mean, I know they have failed a couple of times in recent years. Monaco won it that year when they had a great team, and Lille won it a couple of years ago. But in general, I don't think it's interesting to the outsider. That's personally speaking. To be honest, when PSG signed Lionel Messi, people were saying, wow, Messi and Neymar and Mbappe playing together, that's going to be tremendous to watch. I mean, I don't find it interesting than putting six or seven goals past, you know, much weaker teams. I'd rather those three players were at different clubs and you get, you know, a bit more of a competitive setting. But I think France is quite interesting. I mean, I'm reading a very good book at the moment about French football with Va Va Voom by Tom Williams. He makes some interesting points about the nature of French football in that the rate of urbanisation in France is not very high. So you don't have that many cities. So there aren't that many big groups of population that can sustain big clubs to compete with someone like PSG. And the other interesting thing about France is they don't have any cities, I don't think, where there's more than one club. You know, we're used to Liverpool and Manchester and, of course, London sustaining two clubs. You know, in terms of pure population, PSG should be being challenged by maybe another Parisian club. But you have all the support pretty much going into PSG. And that's obviously without considering the fact that they're a pretty new club. The wealth has come from, if you like, outside France. But it's quite tough, I think, in France for just... It's quite tough, I think, in France for clubs to become certainly European superpowers. And that's what they need to be really to challenge PSG, who are themselves now slightly out of nowhere over the last 10 years, obviously a European superpower.
And I don't think it actually helps PSG in a European sense that they don't get many relevant tests in Ligue 1. A lot of the time, okay, teams are generally starting to press high now more across the board, but often teams will sit back. You'll see more back fives, more defensive approaches. And in terms of the quality, even tactically, it's not always a relevant test for them compared to then trying to prepare themselves for going sort of into Europe. So it's almost like playing one way in the league and then a different way in Europe. And the only thing that's sort of ironic when you then look at France is how well they've done internationally in this time as a you know, senior international side. You know, multiple World Cup finals, World Cup winners, Euros finalists, admittedly losing on sort of home soil, but have been consistently probably one of, if not the best teams in the world over a really sort of long period of time, because the way their league works is that teams don't tend to succeed very well, but individuals keep coming through and keep coming through. So that's kind of the culture that's been developed there.
And it's a bit of a shame that it's so predictable, because if you go back 15 years, Ligue 1 was, I mean, it was never close to the best league, but it was the most competitive league. Mm. You had a period of six seasons where you had six different winners: Lyon, Bordeaux, Marseille, Lille, Montpellier and PSG. Now, the start of that was the end of Lyon's seven in a row, and the end of that was the start of PSG's dominance. But it was really entertaining in that bit in between. You had Giroud's Montpellier came from nowhere, Hazard's Lille, Gourcuff's Bordeaux. I mean, really good teams. Mm. Quite exciting. I think the problem is, obviously, it's a bit of a selling league, and often teams lose the best players.
There's nothing wrong with a bit of disagreement within the room on this pod. We don't have it that often. But Liam, you like Ligue 1, and you think there's more to it than just a procession for PSG. I mean, teams like Brest, you mentioned, a third at the moment. Lens reaching the Champions League last season. For you, that is interesting and, to an extent, competitive.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with Michael's point in that it's not competitive if you look at it through the lens of the winner. But I guess the reason I probably connect with that league is just through watching a lot of youth football and sort of having my roots there, is I enjoy seeing young players sort of coming through and sort of cutting their teeth, so to speak. And you now see a lot of, especially in the Premier League, I think it's one of the biggest leagues exporting into the Prem, if not the biggest, from Ligue 1. You know, people that now will look at, take William Saliba as a prime example of people that watched Ligue 1 however many years ago when he was there, were saying, look, we saw some of these traits now in this player coming through. So it's not trying to be that sort of tactical hipster saying, oh, I knew this person sort of 4 or 5 years ago, but it's nice to be able to see someone come through before they kind of become the finished article, which is just sort of the way that I like to consume football. But I understand that titles and shiny things are also really good fun. So in that regard, you do sort of accept that it's kind of a fatal flaw with that league at the moment, in that, you know, PSG's budget, I think when I was looking on FBref, which the accuracy of those finances might not be 100% guaranteed, but is like four times that of the next biggest team, which is Marseille. And they're kind of renowned for being a bit of a basket case, really.
Yeah, I mean, just on that note, so working with 21st Group on this, they produce these squad values, and PSG's squad value per their numbers is £816 million. The next highest is Rennes on £329 million. It's also interesting, and I know that the whole point of my analysis wasn't to just look at the top and the bottom, but for context, Clermont-Foot's squad value is the lowest, £54 million. So you compare £54 million with £816. That's a big disparity from top to bottom. Again, not the point of the wider competitiveness within the sort of the middle bracket, but huge from top to bottom.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Now into Italy and Serie A. We spoke about its recently crowned champions, Inter Milan, on the podcast just a few weeks ago. Michael, in Serie A, do we have currently the most competitive league when it comes to the title race?
Maybe. I mean, there's been... In Italy, we've had four different winners in five seasons. Juventus, Inter twice, Milan and Napoli. That obviously follows a spell of Juventus winning it nine times in a row. And it feels like across Europe in general, I mean, that was Juventus, PSG, Bayern almost every year. So it was quite boring. The funny thing is that you've had Napoli and Inter win the last two titles. And that is exciting because it was Milan the year before that. So you've had three in three. But they've won it by quite a long way. I mean, Napoli were miles clear by the turn of the year. Inter haven't really had a challenge this year. So it depends what you want. I mean, do you just want different names winning it? Or would you be happier if, you know, if it was Napoli every year and they won it by 2 points from a different team every year? It's, you know, it's two different sides of the debate, really. I suppose you want a bit of both, ideally. But
is that not another layer of competitiveness that clearly even the second, third, fourth best teams in the league find it hard to accrue points at a very high level, maybe because the middle chunk or even the worst teams in the league are providing more competitiveness than in other divisions?
Yeah, that is maybe true. I mean, I think there's always circumstantial situations. I mean, Napoli won the league by miles and then basically got rid of their manager, which obviously didn't help. But yeah, maybe there is something in that. Maybe Serie A teams are, you know, very good at making it difficult for fourth, fifth place teams. But it feels strange to me that it's been quite so inconsistent. I don't really understand. I mean, even if you include the runners-up, I mean, Lazio finished runners-up last year. They haven't been included in the list of teams, I've said, because they haven't won the league since 2000. So you do have a lot of different names popping up. Atalanta have come third three times in the last 6 years. Roma always there or thereabouts. I mean, it is quite exciting in terms of different names, yeah.
And there's another way to look at this. We've spoken purely on a team front, managerially. So there's been a different head coach that's won the league in each of the past six seasons, which is the first time since the late 60s, early 70s. So that, again, speaks to the talent and sort of the depth there. And with four of those, so with Sarri, Pioli, Spalletti and Inzaghi, that's their first ever Scudetto, their first ever Serie A win. And you've had that come at the same period of time where last season Italy had a team in each of the major UEFA finals. Again, that can be another way of looking at it. And again, that might be specifically sort of tactical, the way those teams are, the way the league is, that develops teams that can play good knockout football and in that style. But again, it's sort of, yeah, I think it's always an interesting reflection on how well balanced the league is within itself, but then also when they go outside of that league and they play other teams in Europe.
My next question was going to be, why are clubs that win Serie A struggling to sustain that success into a second season, whether it was Milan, then Napoli, of course? You know, we're now talking about Inter and Simone Inzaghi in incredibly glowing terms, and correctly so. But I feel a bit burnt because we did a podcast on Napoli last year and I haven't heard much about them this season. We did a podcast on Milan the year before and their savvy recruitment and really sort of turning the club around. And then again, things go a little bit quiet for the neutral, for the outsider, because they struggle to sustain it. It feels like we're struggling to understand why exactly that is.
Well, I mean, Liam hinted at it, but it's not just that there's been different managers winning it. It's that three times the manager has won it and then left. So you had Sarri at Juventus, Conte at Inter and Spalletti at Napoli, you know, usually obviously for kind of political reasons rather than them actually just jumping to another job. Mm. They've basically just fallen out with the chairman and left. So that's quite an odd thing. And I think part of that is due to financial concerns. I think these managers win the league and they're like, right, I want a bigger budget. I want to be able to compete in Europe. And that's often not really the case.
I mean, yeah, I'm no financial expert, but my understanding is that Serie A is in quite a bad position financially at the moment. I was reading analysis recently on a platform called Football Benchmark, and they said at the end of last season, Serie A had net debts of 3.2 billion euros across the league. And it's been covered extensively from James Horncastle about how Inter Milan, the current champions, are in hundreds of millions of pounds of debt.
I think be repaid by the end of next month. So you're looking at what's going to be one of the best Serie A seasons ever by a team that have obviously done that as well off the back of being really, really dominant in cups, that even they're massively struggling and have, you know, had to take serious risks to get to this situation.
It was also notable, Mark, in the analysis of team strength and how it varies within each league, that the worst teams per 21st groups model in Serie A are quite significantly worse per their rating system than the worst teams in the Premier League and the worst teams in La Liga. So it seems to have, I guess, what looks like in the data visualization, quite a long tail within it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this was a box and whisker plot for those interested and want to check it out. But yeah, no, you're right. That disparity. And again, we're speaking about competitiveness as the whole league, but that disparity from top to bottom is quite notable. And of those 20, looking at that difference, that range from the highest to the lowest, Serie A was the second highest on the list in terms of that quality gap of team strength. The highest was actually the Eredivisie, which I'm sure we'll come on to with that gap between your popular teams that everyone knows about, PSV, Eindhoven, Ajax, and Feyenoord, compared with those right at the lower end. But Serie A was the second highest on that. So it just goes to show that difference. And as Liam, you know, mentioned, if we're talking about, yeah, the title winners being in a compromised situation financially, then you dread to think what those lower down the top of the Italy's football division is dealing with.
Michael, in researching this episode, I went back and read some of your articles on the Super League fiasco, and it was about the lack of competitiveness across European football. And one phrase that I've pulled out was, you mentioned that in some cases there is structural inequality that manifests itself on the pitch. And I wonder if we talk about La Liga with the real domination of Real Madrid and Barcelona, even if you stretch back 20 years, only two titles haven't gone to one of those two teams. They've had an interesting and quite unique TV deal, which seems to have had the effect of pulling the drawbridge up a little bit on those not named Real Madrid and Barcelona.
Yeah, you're right. The current TV deal isn't as bad as it once was in terms of just directing all the money to the big two, but it is still very different from the Premier League. If you take Atletico out of the equation, they're basically getting double any other side, so double what Sevilla or Real Betis or Valencia gets from TV revenue, which is an issue. It was a greater issue about 10 years ago when they had an even bigger chunk. La Liga has become incredibly predictable. I think it's probably a big three rather than a big two now. I think Atleti have done very well to put themselves in the frame. But you go back to the turn of the century and you had Valencia and Deportivo winning La Liga titles. It's just difficult to imagine anyone else competing now. And that is despite the fact that Sevilla is so good at winning the Europa League. But they've never really challenged in terms of the La Liga title, certainly not in the modern era. So yeah, Spain is very predictable, and it's probably no coincidence that Barcelona and Real Madrid are two of the clubs who are driving the Super League thing, because compared to the Premier League, it's just not exciting. And despite the fact they have massive viewership in the US and South America, I don't think it's particularly compelling week in, week out compared to, for example, the Premier League. Away from home for Real Madrid and Barcelona, I think it's a bit different, but the home games are almost a procession, and they have been for 15 years now.
I will say that I do think it can make the derbies between, or the Clásico in this case, really quite a competitive game. That's something that I don't think there's ever been a point in the past decade and a half where anyone said, this really isn't worth watching. It's a kind of game that everyone, and I'm not a frequent La Liga watcher, but will always sort of try and tune in for that. And you can compare that now to, you know, between Inter and Milan, that Inter have won six derbies in a row, which is the most by either side, either set of cousins, if you will, in entire history. Obviously, and there's then climax with them actually lifting the title, winning the Scudetto in that game. So I think that's another wrinkle to look at, because, and this is where probably, again, France comes into it, of having a lot more regional derbies, because they just don't have, as Michael says, the teams within the cities. So that I think that's a point in terms of, if people aren't going to want to engage with the league, that can often be the buy-in for people, is that sort of your biggest game, that's your poster game. It's why I think part of the English football sells so well because you've got in different parts of the country across London, there's a ridiculous number of London derbies a season.
I realise I'm flying the flag for the wider discussion on the competitiveness rather than just kind of at that top end. But I do think there's something to be said about the wider strength of the likes of Girona. We've spoken about them a lot of the times on this podcast. Athletic Club have done really well this season. Real Sociedad, obviously in the Champions League this season, having done so well last season, they're doing pretty well this season as well. I think there's, yeah, again, the wider point to be made about the competitiveness. And again, speaking about the squad value, again, Barcelona and Real Madrid are on a high, high level, well beyond their nearest competitors. But looking kind of more broadly, so Rayo Vallecano and Cadiz are the only two sides this season whose squad value is less than £100 million, which I think is a really important point to say that every other side, as you can imagine, are above that, which brings that cluster in the middle to show that competitiveness. So there's not that gap that I mentioned before of Clermont-Foot and PSG. There's a lot of teams around that middle area who are really competing for those middle spots.
And in the Bundesliga, we were very excited last week to talk about Bayer Leverkusen, such a wonderful football team. And even since we've spoken about them, that the lengths that they have gone to stay unbeaten have been quite remarkable. They've broken the Bayern Munich monopoly. I do think it's worth mentioning Stuttgart as well, who, you know, have probably flown under the radar due to Bayer Leverkusen's success, but they are third, having picked up 2.1 points per game this season. It's a club who's suffered two relegations in the last eight seasons, so a remarkable success this season. Dortmund last year, Mark, were close to winning the league title off Bayern. Are we about to have a more open Bundesliga era?
It's hard to say, not least because Bayern Munich are just so big. They are a powerhouse of a club, and I know from speaking to Seb Staffer-Blohr about just how much the coverage of Bayern Munich, it's just every German football coverage is centred towards Bayern Munich, and it is representative of the attention on them and, of course, then the financial clout that they have. So I think that Bayer Leverkusen's performance this season does kind of go against the grain because they are, and every other club who's not named Bayern Munich, are at a disadvantage in terms of the weight within the country. But, you know, as you say, Dortmund almost did it. I think because Dortmund almost did it a couple of seasons ago, Leverkusen's done it this season, I think it's going to anger Bayern Munich. It's going to wake the beast even more this season. I think they'll put all their energy and efforts into just making sure that this doesn't happen again because they are such an institution that I think that they can't kind of handle the political backlash, which we're already seeing as it's happened this season. So I don't know. That's my prediction, but I think that we'll almost probably see a return to the monopoly.
And compared to the other top five Euro leagues, Michael, a very specific ownership situation and the way that clubs are owned and run.
Yeah, they are supporter owned, at least 50% plus one of the shares, or the majority of them are. They're very proud of that model. I think there's unquestionably some great things about it. Low ticket prices, good community links, usually very good atmospheres. Obviously, the slight issue is that this system has produced an incredibly predictable league in recent years, and the side who have smashed the monopoly are one of the few who do not adhere to the 50 plus one principles. You know, you can look at France and you can say the opposite thing. You know, they've had outside investors come into PSG and they've made that league, you know, a complete monopoly as well. But clubs in Germany are constrained more than equivalents in other European leagues, and I don't think you're going to get teams who come from completely nowhere to compete with Bayern because they just don't have the finance to do so, with the exception of the two or three sides who are run like not German clubs.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager. Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army Knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it. Tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
So outside of the so-called Big Five European leagues, I found this chunk of leagues really interesting, Mark, both from a sort of team quality point of view, but also the different aspects of competitiveness within them. The Segunda División in Spain is the next strongest league in terms of average team quality, which I think is fascinating. As for the top tiers, you've got Portugal, Russia, Netherlands, then Belgium, then the Zweite Bundesliga in Germany, the second tier there, the Championship in England, and then the Superliga of Denmark, followed by Switzerland and Serie B of Italy. So quite a few second tiers there. There's really unique aspects of the other top tiers that we're talking about. For example, when we talk about competitiveness, average team quality within the Netherlands and Portugal in particular is very, very skewed by a huge variety in team quality at top and bottom. So what does that chuck up with those leagues?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting discussion on this because you do have, I mentioned it before, so in the Netherlands you've got Ajax, maybe not as much this season, but Ajax, Feyenoord and PSV. And in Portugal, you've got Porto, Sporting and Benfica. And those sides are all of a sort of a general quality of European level strength in terms of competing in the Europa League and in the Champions League. And the players within that as well do move from league to league because they are clearly very, very elite players. But when you look at the lower echelons of those leagues, the sort of level that we're talking about are kind of the equivalent of the English Championship and League One sides. So if you are a player who is, let's say, a striker and you're scoring an average of one or two goals a game, that needs to be absolutely filled with context that the type of opposition that you're coming up against is a lot weaker. So you're made to look potentially like a world beater when, you know, if you were to move into a stronger league or a more competitive league, or both, like the Premier League, that needs to be accounted for from an analytics perspective, obviously from a recruitment perspective, to adapt and adjust those numbers to think, okay, if they were to move into this league where, yeah, that quality gap is a lot smaller from top to bottom, then how will they fare then? So the equivalent of one or two goals becomes 0-1 goals per 90 minutes in the Premier League by way of comparison. So I think it does need to be kind of filled with context in that regard. And we've seen it with some examples from those leagues that I mentioned before. So, you know, Antony at Manchester United, Noni Madueke at Chelsea, Cody Gakpo to a certain extent, obviously at Liverpool in the Eredivisie, not absolutely hit the ground running this season, having come straight directly from the Eredivisie. And from Portugal, again, to a certain extent, there might be a bit of debate on this, but Darwin Nunes and Enzo Fernandez, both coming from Benfica into the Premier League. I think there's a really interesting conversation to be had there.
I think it's interesting in the context of a real name of the moment, Victor Gyökeres, who's scoring so many goals for Sporting, having scored a fair few for Coventry City in the Championship last season. He's doing it on a continental level as sporting player in continental competitions. Within the league level, a lot of the teams that he is scoring against are, well, 21st group would say, of a lot lower quality than the worst teams in the Championship that he was scoring against last year. And yet the narrative changes quite strongly, doesn't it, Liam, that I think for fans of Premier League clubs in particular, it seems much more exciting to be buying Sporting's striker scoring 40 goals than Coventry City's striker scoring 20, 25 goals. But the difference in purchase price is about 50 million quid.
Yeah, and it's also then the effect of, and I know Mark's done stuff on this before, of playing for a dominant team and how then important all the state in the game in which those goals come as well, that when you're in such an attacking team and you are smashing teams to bits, you're going to get greater service that you then need to factor in. So it's not just sort of the quality. Then there's, even down to the individual player level, technical and tactical repercussions of, okay, if you're then getting chances where you've got more time or more space to finish, you can take more touches, you're getting more low cutbacks, not, say, easier chances, but there might be less variety than someone that's having to sort of score left foot, right foot header, chase the channels a lot more. And that will need to just basically be factored into the relevance of your own team. And if you're saying, look, if this is how we want to play, and it's part of the reason why I maintain that from a Brighton perspective, when they sold him as an academy graduate, he made sense to be sold at the time. And for better or for worse, that was because it was during Graham Potter's time at the club. He wanted a number nine who could drop in a lot more, play with their back to goal and link play to, you know, sort of these number 10s or you know, the attacking sort of fullbacks. People will understandably critique that with they didn't score an awful lot of goals in that time and could have done with a striker that scored that number of goals. And he consistently came out and said in transfer windows, you know, there's no silver bullet of this player that exists in our budget that we can suddenly pluck from somewhere. And then I feel like we're quite nicely talking about what people will quite crudely describe as like a Bundesliga or insert other league tax. But there clearly is some truth and some value to this in terms of then the adaptation and making that jump from those leagues into one that's got high quality, but also different technical and tactical demands, which impact based on players and their tendencies.
Yeah, I mean, for me, recruitment and quality of players is a slightly different conversation. But what I like is competitive title races and different teams winning it. And in Netherlands and Portugal, you've got pretty similar situation where you've got three really big clubs in both countries. It can get a bit predictable because it is basically those three and everyone else, almost two different divisions within one division. But actually, they're quite unpredictable and competitive from season to season. So in the Netherlands, PSV are going to win the league this year. The previous season it was Feyenoord, and the previous season it was Ajax. You've got three in three. And it's a pretty similar situation in Portugal. I mean, they've got a situation where no one's successfully defending the title. You have to go back to 2016 and 2017 when Benfica did it. Since then, it's been Benfica, Porto, Sporting, Porto, Benfica, and probably Sporting this year. So that's kind of fine. I mean, you know, this is not a new development in these kind of countries. I mean, in Portugal, only twice since the Second World War that anyone else aside from the big three has won the league. Belenenses says the first year in 1946, and Boavista, who came from nowhere to win it in 2001. So these countries are basically accustomed to that. I think as long as it's different ones winning it every season, or pretty close to that, then that's pretty much fine.
So linking this all back to, you mentioned at the start about the youth league, it's one of the reasons why they valued that coming in as a competition in Portugal. One of the people that was interviewed, João Trojo, for the piece, who coached Benfica, or their youth league team, the under-19s, for five seasons, and they got to the final twice. He said that the tournament coming in was huge news for us and for Portuguese football because it was a greater challenge than the domestic leagues. It was the boost that we needed because on the national level, the dominance of the big teams, the big three that Michael's referencing, was already well established. And they've got 19s teams that will play in an under-19 league, but they'll then have their 21s, often the bigger clubs, and this happens in Belgium, Portugal, Spain, I think, as well, and the Netherlands, that play in a second or third tier and that will play against senior teams. So they've got then that balance of, that can impact, I guess, the competitivity of those leagues where you say we're going to sort of sacrifice the quality of the Premier going all the way down to try and make our good players even better and get them more sort of tests against people that are more experienced, that are physically better because they're going to be really good technically, but we want to sort of push them. And that's obviously the complete flip side to England, where the pyramid goes really, really deep and isn't then sort of a vessel, if you like, for those sort of younger players to come through.
The Danish Superliga piqued my interest after reading this piece. Same for TN in the comments, who said, the Danish league is quite good. You can find cheaper but similarly good players as the Eredivisie or Portugal, despite the latter having a much better reputation. Three different winners in the last 4 or 5 years. FC Copenhagen have won the last two, but it looks like it won't be them this time around. So a little bit of variability amongst the winners. It's also an interesting division in its format, where the league splits and we get a championship group and we get a relegation group. Of course, Michael, there are other European leagues where this is the case. The top division in Belgium being another example where, you know, by Premier League standards, there's a bit of funkiness. They split things up and they look to decide titles just in a slightly different way to how the top five Euro leagues work. What do you make of different league formats and how they help or otherwise with competitiveness?
Well, the thing the league format has got going for it is, one, you can be pretty assured that the best team will win it. As I've said earlier, I don't think that's always a good thing. And of course, you've got the history. I mean, in England, going back to the 19th century, we've pretty much played the league in the same way every year. But I think with the differences in quality now, if you're constructing a league or a division from scratch, you probably just don't have a straight league format. And that's why a lot of modern competitions, you know, in cricket, T20, for example, or in MLS, where, you know, America's used to playing a playoff at the end of the season, you do have a different type of way to decide the title winners. And, you know, it's funny, we're very kind of set in our ways in that we all agree that domestic titles should be a league. We all agree that a European Cup should be knockout, World Cup should be knockout. There's not necessarily any great logic to that, aside from, you could say, maybe time constraints. So yeah, I think if you're inventing a new league tomorrow and you've got, let's say you're in France, do you have a straight league format? I think you probably have some kind of exciting end of season playoffs where other teams do have a chance to overhaul PSG. Maybe it's a more interesting televisual event. And I think this, the split league thing's quite fun as well, because I think that's quite a nice blend where it's still a league format, but you do have almost like playoffs where you have the big teams playing each other. And I mean, this is an issue in England, for example, in the WSL, where you have a league that is increasing in terms of its popularity. It's only 12 teams at the moment. If you expand that to 14 or 16, you're going to risk going back to the days where you had like 8-0, 9-0 kind of scorelines. So if the argument, you know, if you want more games, and that in itself is a debate because maybe players are being overplayed, I think a split league works quite well. You know, from a 12-team league, split it in half, and then you can have the top half playing each other, the bottom half playing each other, and you have automatically, you have more competitive games.
Really interesting. And, you know, I have to make sure we touch on the second tier question here, because as I said earlier, some of them come out very strong, certainly in terms of the average team quality model, the Segunda División in Spain, then the Zweite Bundesliga, the Championship, and Serie B stand out as the sort of big four when it comes to second tiers. Of course, they are inherently different structurally in that the best teams go up every year and the worst teams go down every year, Mark. So intuitively to me, and this is why in particular I love the Championship, it gives a different feel to the league every single year. Different teams are good and poor every single year, broadly. And therefore, there is a very natural and inherent excitement within the competitiveness and the structure of those leagues.
Yeah, I agree. I think, yeah, it makes complete sense. I have a fondness for the Segunda División because of, I think I mentioned before in this podcast, I like to follow Real Oviedo and they're perennially close to the playoffs. But I think that kind of speaks to the competitiveness point, because it is always so close that you are, much like the English Championship, you are only a couple of wins away from kind of reaching the top six, top four, whatever it may be.
And at the moment, in the second tier in Spain, there's only 11 points separating the top 11 teams. Yeah. That's sporting utopia for me.
Yeah, and Leganés are top of the league and they have just 63 points and they've played, I think, 36 games, maybe just shy of it. And they've drawn four of their last five, which is not form for someone who should be at the top of the league. And yeah, again, it speaks to the point you made statistically, that quality gap. And it's just talking about the range here. The Segunda División has the smallest gap from top to bottom of the 20 that we discussed. So it's, yeah, hugely interesting, as are a lot of the, as you mentioned, the second divisions. And there's that element of peril. Obviously, you get to be promoted into the top European leagues if you win it or get in the top two or three. So yeah, it's hugely competitive with lucrative reward, and it makes sense that there is, you know, a cluster of similar quality teams as a consequence.
This often seems to be the case in the Spanish second division, and I think it's partly to do with away travel. I mean, it's a very big country, Spain. It's not that easy to navigate. They don't have that much culture of away fans. I mean, even in La Liga, if the away team scores a goal and the camera goes to the fans, you have like 150 fans at like massive grounds. And just looking at the league table at the moment, everyone's played about 18 away games. No one's won more than 8 of them on the road. Leganés are from Madrid, so probably relatively easy travel for them. But anyway, that's probably getting too far away from the point. But it is a bit of a feature in Spain that the Segunda is always really competitive.
I think that's really interesting. And within your answer, I've pulled up the current season stats for the Segunda División, in which the away team has only won 23% of total matches this season. In the Championship, where there's a much bigger onus on away travel and much smaller distances to travel, the away teams have won 32% of the games. So it's almost a 10% difference there in away win percentage. Very good, Michael. Very good. There was a comment from Jamie H. that said, I reckon a European competition with the Championship, second Bundesliga, Segunda División and Serie B would be decent. Now, part of me thinks we've got enough competitions at the moment to wrap our heads around, but a lot of me thinks that would be very, very interesting just from a sort of footballing perspective to see how those second tier teams would mesh together.
You could do like an end of season, you know, playoff, like get four of them, semi-finals, final. Mm. Obviously, it'd be a bit weird if you did it like the main European competitions, because obviously it'd be the winners of the Championship who would then be in the Premier League and struggling. That would just seem really weird. But end of season, when the FA Cup final, whatever's going on, could be a good alternative.
It's worth a brainstorm at the very least, somewhere in Nyon, no doubt. So many aspects of this whole conversation, so many unique variables across different divisions and different nations. Mark, this has been occupying your mind now for over 2 weeks. What would you say you have learned from researching competitiveness to that level?
I think in general, it's interesting to move away from the league strength. Everyone's so obsessed, especially recently, with these UEFA coefficients and my league's better than your league and all that sort of chat. And I think it's just so much more interesting to speak about the peril of the league, the competitiveness of the league in terms of the entertainment value, irrespective of strength of the league or the players themselves. How do you like to sort of consume your football? And how much of a virtuous cycle it is to have that greatest competitiveness that then attracts more attention to that league more broadly. And then that in turn can make it stronger and you can kind of build from the foundation up. So I think that's one of them. The second one would be that recruitment perspective that we've already spoken about. But again, I'm obviously very interested from an analytics perspective, and it's so important to add that context to it. If you're looking to sign a player from an already dominant side, acknowledging that gap from top to bottom, that disparity between certain teams, and adapting that output that they have. So I think those are my two main ones. And let's have it right as well, by the way. This is going on within clubs in terms of adapting their analytics and the quality of the league. That's why you're not often going to get that player move from the Danish Superliga directly into the Premier League because of that lack of competitiveness in certain situations.
Well done, Mark, and thank you for bringing this to our door. There was a predictably tedious cabal of people responding to your article by saying this was some way of you coping with the Premier League clubs being knocked out of various UEFA competitions. But I think, and I hope we've proven over the last hour or so, that there's a little more to it than that. Thank you for listening to this week's Athletic Football Tactics podcast. We hope that you've enjoyed it and that you subscribe to this podcast feed so that you get next week's episode as soon as it lands. Head to theathletic.com/tactics to sign up for an Athletic subscription with an annual discount today. And we look forward to being with you again next week on the Athletic Football Tactics podcast.
The Athletic.